Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This season, pro football's holiday gift to fans across the country is widespread hope. Unless you root for the Bengals, the Texans, or the Lions, your team had a shot at the playoffs until quite recently, or else it still does. If no team is spectacularly good, then very few teams are spectacularly bad. Joining me from his office in Virginia to comment on the NFL's remarkable landscape is Paul Attner, who covers the league for the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill, for having me back.
Tell me a little bit about this situation where, at season's end, we could get an 11-way tie for best record in the American Football Conference. I know the NFL wants parity, but is this really what the league had in mind?
They're passing out Rubik's Cubes for everybody to solve, too, at the same time. You know, I would think this is the ultimate dream of the NFL. Yes, I think that they want this type of equality, and they want everybody in these cities to be thinking their team still can win the Super Bowl, and they're just counting their blessings and all the money that's pouring through the coffers for what this is producing right now.
The Miami Dolphins and the Tennessee Titans are two teams that should make the playoffs. What other AFC teams do you like in the postseason?
Well, you're brave, aren't you?
With 11 of them up to tie, yeah, I think so.
Well, I'll go on the limb with you, Bill, on this one. Let's, you know, Oakland certainly should make it. They're, if not the best team in the AFC, one of the best teams. Beyond that, it's just as hard as it seems, because I think you've got three solid teams in the AFC, and the rest are not that good of teams, and they all could either win or lose in these final weeks, and then we'll get three pretenders and three real teams, and the three pretenders will get eliminated right away.
The New England Patriots are one of the teams that could win the division or could fail to make the playoffs with 2 weeks left. One gets the feeling that either way, this is not exactly going to be New England's year to repeat.
Yeah, I certainly classify them as a pretender, and as you know, Bill, in our previous conversations, I didn't think New England was going to repeat as Super Bowl champions, and I really didn't think they were a lock to make the playoffs. This has not been their field of dreams, because their team last year overachieved, and this year they played more like regular players and not super players, and the result's been basically a 500 season, you know, just about a 500 season for them.
While the AFC is in relative chaos, the NFC playoff brackets are almost all set. However, Green Bay, Tampa Bay, Philadelphia have really separated themselves from the rest of the pack, I think. Who do you think has the edge among that group?
Well, Philadelphia is the best team in the NFC if they can get their quarterback, Donovan McNabb, back in the playoffs from his broken foot. If he doesn't get back, then I think at that point it really depends on who wins home field advantage among those three teams, any of whom can win home field advantage with 2 weeks left. Tampa Bay probably has the next best defense, but Green Bay, because of Brett Favre, the next best offense. So if McNabb comes back, I like Philadelphia. If he doesn't, you know, it's hard to choose between the other two teams.
Maybe the most exciting player in the NFC playoffs will be Atlanta quarterback Michael Vick. He's apparently a favorite among many to be league MVP. Is he that good yet?
I think his play has dropped off, Bill, a little bit the last couple of weeks, and I don't think he will be MVP, but he certainly will get MVP votes. But the thing about Atlanta right now is they better not drop off anymore either, or they may not make the playoffs. And, you know, they look like a lock a couple of weeks ago, and that will really depend on Vic, you know, being able to finish it off. I mean, this is a long season for him, first time he's been a starter for a whole season, and I think it's starting to catch up with him a little bit. He has to play well these last 2 weeks, and if he does, then the Falcons get in, and that certainly will enhance his MVP choice, because I'll tell you something, I'm voting on various MVP ballots, and I'm not going to make any selection until the very last minute, because I think it's so close right now, it'd be stupid to do it early.
All right, Paul, are you ready for some technical talk?
Bill, if it's coming from you, I'm ready.
Okay. Now, I attended two, not one, but two Patriots press conferences this season, and in one of them, Coach Bill Belichick spoke of how successfully some of his players were achieving lateral separation. Why didn't he just say his guys were good at running away from the other team's guys?
Because it's a complex game, Bill. I mean, if they make it too simple, Bill, then they have to admit that maybe sports writers and fans know what we talk about once in a while. See, so the clue is to make this like nuclear science and not be able to solve it and give us this mystique and mystery to keep us coming back for more of that educational talk that you received at that press conference. Mm-hmm.
Have you got some more favorite terms? I mean, I haven't found anything I like better than lateral separation.
Oh, I just like always the vertical game. I think that's that's one of my favorites. We're going into the vertical game, whatever mm-hmm. that is. I can imagine when people looking at thinking of Wilt Chamberlain when they see the vertical game. It doesn't quite lend itself to the NFL, but that's one of my favorites right now.
Something else that's been fun this year, San Francisco wide receiver Terrell Owens keeps topping his own touchdown celebrations. Last week he grabbed a pair of pom-poms and briefly was the biggest cheerleader in 49er history. I don't know what we should expect from him next.
Well, I sat down with him about a month ago and right after his Sharpie incident, and he said, I'm planning some more things. So I can imagine he's still planning other things. Maybe the next time he'll just hop in his pants and take a seat next to somebody and get a beer and a hot dog. I mean, that may be the next step in his progression here.
Well, I'm wondering if, given the time of year, we can expect some sort of holiday motif. Maybe he gets himself pulled around the field in a big red sleigh or gets elves to jump out from under his helmet, something like that.
I like that. I really do. That would be maybe we should pass it on to him as give him a little creative juice to ponder in these last few days.
Paul Attner covers football for the Sporting News. Paul, thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk to you when the playoffs begin.
Hey, Bill, thank you a lot. I appreciate it.
The 5-9 Arizona Cardinals have the worst attendance in the National Football League this season. An average of about 40,000 people have attended each of the Cardinals' 7 home games at 70,000-seat Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe. But as Steve Goldstein of member station KJZZ recently discovered, intrepid area scalpers have not been dissuaded.
A typical NFL Sunday from Jacksonville to Oakland includes tailgating, fans clad in the home team's jersey, and painted faces. But Arizona Cardinals games are anything but typical. Most attendees arrive dressed in the visiting team's colors, and empty seats outnumber Arizona fans. The low attendance figures aren't lost on scalpers like Rick.
It hurts us.
Does it?
Yeah.
What's your pitch? What's your appeal? Why should people buy from you and not from the box office?
Because we got them cheaper.
How do you do that?
We lose money.
Always?
Most of the time.
Losing money is something these entrepreneurs have in common, but some, like Gary, are still optimistic.
Do you think you're going to make a profit off this?
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that work?
You buy tickets for less than you sell them for. Supply and demand. I can buy them cheaper than they sell them there and sell them for more.
But that lesson in economics is lost on one season ticket holder named Scott. He's still trying to get something, almost anything, for his seats.
What's the face value of them?
$49.50.
Have you had any takers?
Yeah, if I wanted to take $10 a piece, and I won't do it. I'd eat the tickets for $10 a piece.
The Cardinals moved to Phoenix in 1988 from St. Louis and immediately established the highest ticket prices in the NFL. The Cards' only playoff appearance was in 1998. The timing couldn't have been better, because a referendum to build a new stadium for the team happened to be on the ballot at the time. It passed, and the team soon returned to the NFC cellar, where they've since remained. Now NFL apathy has taken hold in the Phoenix area. Arizona State University professor Stephen Happel says the Cardinals should recognize that fact and introduce something revolutionary.
Selling these tickets in the secondary market bring people into the stands to buy concessions, and the concessions are huge markups. So in some ways, if the Cardinals are making just great markups on the concessions, they've got to open the gates at halftime and let everybody in and let them get drunk and eat pretzels and make money that way, you know, turn it into a big party.
Cardinals with their red tops, white pants.
As of last Sunday, Professor Happel's plan hadn't been implemented, and as kickoff time arrived at Sun Devil Stadium on the Arizona State University campus, scalpers were still trying to unload tickets. One of them had just received a warning from a campus police officer. Most of the scalpers left on Sunday with tickets still in hand. 16 stadium ticket windows remained open during the game, but no one queued up after the game had started. Perhaps that was because the 4-8 Cardinals were hosting the 3-9 Lions. The teams played before the NFL's smallest crowd of the season, 28,640. but at least Arizona was able to break a long losing streak with an overtime victory.
This to win it for the Cardinals. A 43-yard attempt, the snap, the spot, the kick, has the leg, and it's good, and the Cardinals win it in overtime. The six-game slide is over, thank the Lord.
That win 2 weeks ago did Phoenix area scalpers no good, because the Cardinals played in and lost to St. Louis last weekend. But the Cardinals will play their final home game of the 2002 season this afternoon against the San Francisco 49ers. Plenty of good seats are still available. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Tempe, Arizona.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. But no matter how far away you roam, when you pine for the sunshine of a friendly gaze, for the holidays you can't be home sweet home.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
If you want to be happy in a million ways, for the holidays you can't beat home sweet home.
For the holidays you can't beat home.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The girls' under 18 field hockey side at Perth School in Cambridge, England, entered the fall season with a problem: no goalkeeper. No worries, though. George Heritage, a 17-year-old male student at Perth, came to the rescue. "I'd normally have been playing rugby," he explained, "but because of an injury, I couldn't take part." Hence, Heritage, the goalkeeper for the boys' under-18 team, stepped in for the girls, a circumstance agreed to by all of Perth's opponents. "It's nice to be surrounded by women," young Heritage said. He also acknowledged that it was good practice.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. Mount Auburn Club, Health Racket Club and Spa, celebrating more than 28 years of fitness education support and results. Mount Auburn Club, full of life, mountauburnclub.com. Johnson Drugs in Waltham, a health and wellness pharmacy offering an integration of mainstream and complementary medicine, with an extensive selection of nutritional supplements, herbal medicines, and homeopathic remedies. A bitter family dispute over the remains of Red Sox legend Ted Williams is over. For more on this story, go to WBUR.org, click on News, then Sports. The weather forecast: today sunny, then becoming partly sunny later today, breezy with highs in the mid-40s, partly cloudy tonight, then becoming mostly clear, lows in the 30s, and partly sunny on Sunday, highs in the upper 40s. 36 degrees in Boston, 36 in Hyannis at 720. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, World War I soldiers who chose soccer over slaughter. But first, since August, when its sixth season came to an end, the WNBA has been busier than ever. The league has been restructured, two franchises ceased operations, another changed cities, the league and the union have been negotiating a new collective bargaining agreement, and ownership groups in several cities have placed bids to bring a team to town, leaving WNBA President Val Ackerman with just barely enough time to talk to us by phone from her office. Ms. Ackerman, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Val, NBA President David Stern has said the restructuring of the WNBA took the league out of what he called its incubation period. Most notable among the changes, WNBA teams can now be located in non-NBA cities and owned by non-NBA owners. After 6 years, why did the league decide to change the way it does business?
Well, we felt we needed to make some changes to try to get the league to continue to move forward in terms of our fan development, in terms of our revenue opportunities. And the restructuring that the NBA board approved allows our teams now to be sold off independently of the NBA teams in the cases where the NBA operator is involved, which is a major change and one that we hope will inspire some additional investment in terms of resources and staff as our teams look to build up their assets. And secondly, and the new model gives us the flexibility to pursue ownership operation and operational opportunities in non-NBA cities. And we think that's going to allow us to strengthen our local operations, get us into some cities where we think the fans will be supportive of women's pro basketball and hopefully allow the league to continue to grow.
While attendance was up last year, some of the other statistics were not so encouraging. Television ratings were down. Three franchise operators chose not to become owners when the league was restructured. Those would seem to be worrisome developments, no?
We're clearly in a period of transition. When we started the league back in 96 and launched in 97, we made it plain that we knew that it was going to take a long time to develop the league, that we might have some steps back for every couple of steps forward. And clearly now we're going to be in a period of transition that I predict is going to probably evolve over the next couple of years. So these changes, they are what they are. We hope the league will come out ahead because of them, but we still think that the other indicators that are important are there for us. We know the NBA is behind us. The game is evolving and getting better every year. Women's basketball is played at so many levels that the players we get in every year from the colleges and so forth are better than the ones before. We've been able to secure blue-chip corporate support. We have a national network agreement that'll run another 6 years. So we think some of the signs that are most important are actually very encouraging, and we're still pretty optimistic about the future.
Your office has acknowledged that the league might contract to less than 16 teams next year, although the number would likely bounce back in 2004. But Paul Allen of the Portland Trail Blazers is on the fence about taking on ownership of the Fire. The Seattle Storm needs either a new lease or a new place to play. Are you confident there will be 14 teams on the court next year?
We'll know for sure by the end of this month. It's all but certain that we're going to have less than 16 because of some decisions of certain operators not to go forward. Should that prove to be true, which I believe it will be, we expect that in 04 we're going to be able to bring some teams back online and bring that number back up. But there is a chance that we would go down, and if so, I think the plus is that we would be in cities where the operations would be strong. To the extent we would have to disperse some of the players, I think the quality of play in the league would be enhanced. And I think, as I said earlier, that in the end we'll probably be better off for it.
The WNBA's main rival, the ABL, folded almost exactly 3 years ago after just 2.5 seasons. The WNBA has lasted this long in part because of the support of the National Basketball Association. Are you confident that that support will remain strong as your league goes along if it doesn't start making money?
Yes, I'm confident that for the foreseeable future, the NBA is going to be behind us. There seem to be a variety of benefits to the NBA in having a league that's attracting a different audience, that's extending its reach throughout the calendar year, that's allowing its teams to build basketball on a year-round basis in its respective cities to the extent that NBA owners are involved. But ultimately, we know we're a business, and that's important. And women's basketball, in the end, has to be able to prove that the interest and the corporate support and the fan support and media support is all going to be there, because in the end, that's really what we need in order to prove to the NBA that that we're a business worth being in.
Val Ackerman is the president of the WNBA. Val, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
Just over 88 years ago, on Christmas Eve, 1914, a gruesome and brutal war was briefly interrupted by a number of spontaneous truces. Up and down the battle line that stretched across western France, groups of combatants, the Germans on one side, the English and their allies on the other, met in no man's land to acknowledge Christmas. They listened to each other sing carols, they traded gifts, and on the pocked fields between their respective lines of barbed wire and filthy trenches, they played soccer. In Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce, Stanley Weintraub recounts tales of those unlikely events. Stanley Weintraub joins me now from member station WPSU in State College, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
You write that in the official histories of the war, the Christmas truce is dismissed as, quote, an aberration of no consequence. Given that it only lasted a matter of hours or days at the most, and that the war went on for almost four more years, why shouldn't the Christmas truce be so dismissed?
It was of utterly no consequence as far as ending the war was concerned. But had the war ended at that time, there would have been perhaps 20 million fewer dead. A generation of young men would not have been wiped out. Perhaps the world would have been a great deal different. We have no way of knowing. But it represents something else, too. It seems to me to be the last gasp of chivalry in wartime, the last gasp of real brotherhood, the recognition that the people on the other side were like you. And one of the most famous songs remembering the Christmas truce is one by John McCutcheon called Christmas in the Trenches. In it, a trooper from Liverpool says that one thing we learned in the Christmas truce was that on both ends of the rifle were the same. And I don't think that recognition has occurred since.
And one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave and held.
It's probably hard for most people today to imagine how dreadful the conditions in the trenches during World War I were. You quote one German artist who calls the battlefront the work of the devil.
Yes, this was Otto Dix, described the landscape of fortified ditches as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, shells, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. And the troops were grateful for this interlude to celebrate Christmas. It was certainly spontaneous. The governments had no idea that this was going to happen. When they encouraged a bit of morale-boosting gifts to be sent to the troops, and the Germans even sent small Christmas trees, the British were first baffled and then mesmerized by seeing those lights like footlights in a theater across the expanse of no man's land. And it was not a big expanse. No man's land wasn't any wider than the width of a football field from spectators on one side to spectators on the other.
Right.
That meant that the troops could hear each other, could see each other, even shoot at each other almost point blank. It was death to raise your head above a trench. But the Germans, with their Christmas trees, not only lit the candles on the trees, but began singing Silent Night. And the British recognized Silent Night. It was their song, too. And pretty soon, carols and other songs began wafting across the trenches from side to side. You couldn't have done anything in no man's land, even at the time of the truce, without getting rid of the corpses. No man's land might have been only 65 or 70 yards wide, but over the weeks of war, it had filled with corpses. Christmas morning, they buried the bodies jointly. They were moving informal services. Both sides recognized that they knew the 23rd Psalm. It was repeated in German and in English. The bodies were buried. And once the bodies were buried, they had a football pitch, a soccer pitch.
They had a place where they could play soccer. And whose idea was it initially to have a competition at soccer?
I think it happened spontaneously up and down the line. It was the working man's game.
Mm-hmm.
They longed for that opportunity. The Scott troops kilted in that terrible weather. The Scott troops even brought soccer balls into the trenches and hoped for a chance to use them. As strange as it sounds, there really were games played with improvised balls as well as with real ones. What they did was use a woolen cap, filled it with straw, sometimes with mud or sand, and tied it up with whatever string they could find, and that became a ball. We learn a lot of these stories. In one case, the game ended in a draw. The Times and other newspapers published letters from the troops about the games, which were later denied by the government.
Of course, because that would have been counter to their obvious ambitions.
They wanted the war to go on. They wanted the hatred that propaganda had encouraged. But the Times published one letter from a major in the medical corps as early as January 1st, 1915, reporting that in his sector, after the Saxons sang "God Save the King" to our people, one of his men was given a bottle of wine to drink to the king's health, following which his regiment had a football match with the Saxons, who beat them 3-2. Then you find the English account, when I was doing research, supported by the official war chronicle of the 133rd Saxon Regiment, which described the scene of Tommy and Fritz, as they called them. And the German report says that the game ended 3-2 for Fritz.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned before a game that ended in a draw and another one ending 3-2. All the games that are accounted for in your book are close. It's almost as if neither side wanted to embarrass the other.
It could be. They were really playing a gentlemanly sport. It was very clear that they were not out to show that one side was better than the other. They were just delighted at the opportunity.
You write of the war itself, quote, "Both sides were misled by half-truths. Beneath the artificial hatred, each respected the other. Victory, if it came at all, would be long delayed, costly, and worthless. Perhaps a football match, after which both sides went home, might be a better solution." And I gather there were soldiers on both sides who felt that way.
Yes, William Dawkins of the East Kents recalled, "It was told to me that our lieutenant colonel threatened our soldiers with machine guns. Mm. Had one of those big mouths," he meant upper-level officers, "gathered together 10,000 footballs, what a happy solution that would have been without bloodshed."
What a beautiful thought.
Of course, it didn't happen. There were nearly four more years of war, three more Christmases of war. There never was another Christmas truce. There hasn't been another one in the history of warfare before or since. And millions died and nothing gained. Because the peace led to another war in 1939, the Second World War.
Of the truce, at one point in the book you write, "Christmas 1914 evokes the stubborn humanity within us and suggests an unrealized potential." I know you wrote those words some years ago, but I wonder if you feel they have particular meaning once again now.
I think they have meaning that is ironic in the circumstances, because we can only have truces of the sort that were celebrated by those men in 1914 at Christmas when you have a common culture across the no man's land, when the troops believe in the same thing, have the same backgrounds roughly. And you could do that then because not only did both sides sing Silent Night, for example, the Germans were even able to sing Tipperary in German back to the British. And but how can you do that with a culture that's alien? I was a young officer in the Korean War. We had no common contacts. They didn't talk our language. They didn't look like us. They didn't sound like us. There was nothing we had that was in any way compatible. The same thing could certainly be said of a potential war in Iraq or a potential war anywhere where there isn't a commonality of culture.
There is the commonality of soccer, though, interestingly enough. The Koreans play soccer. The Iraqis play soccer. The U.S., the English, they all play soccer. There
yes,
is kind
it's,
of
it's,
the hope of that kind of commonality, perhaps.
It is the world game, certainly. When they talk about the World Cup, it means something about soccer. But I don't recall any attempt to play soccer between the two sides in Korea. I was there for two Christmases during the war. Nothing like that ever happened. I don't know if that attempt was even thought of. Maybe now that there has been a revival of interest in that Christmas truce, we'll think about that again.
Stanley Weintraub's Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce, recently became available in paperback from Plume Press. Mr. Weintraub, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. Glad to have been with you.
It was Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they'd kept between us to exact the work of war had been crumbled and were gone forevermore. Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver, in Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas come since World War I, I've learned its lessons well. But the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle, we're the same.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a unique grocery store where buyers travel the world to find products like French rack of lamb, New York-style cheesecake, and heat-and-eat hors d'oeuvres. More at TraderJoe's.com. Volunteers of America, locally helping people make positive life changes through support from late-model vehicle donations. Information at voamass.org. At Stanhope Framers, providing fine contemporary and period frames for individuals and museums for more than 25 years. Located in Back Bay, Boston and Union Square, Somerville, 617-262-0787. Good morning, I'm Bob Sehan. In the sports headlines, the Celtics snapped a four-game home losing streak against the Minnesota Timberwolves with a 108-99 win last night. Paul Pierce scored 42 points, just four shy of a season high, and grabbed 14 rebounds. The Bruins will try and reverse their five-game losing streak when they face the Florida Panthers at the Fleet Center tonight. And the Patriots may be shorthanded on defense for their critical Sunday night game against the New York Jets at Gillette Stadium. Veteran cornerback Otis Smith is out for the season with a shoulder injury. The weather forecast calling for sunny skies this morning, then becoming partly sunny later today. It will be breezy with highs in the mid-40s. Partly cloudy tonight, then becoming mostly clear, lows in the 30s. And partly sunny on Sunday, highs in the upper 40s. There are just a few seats left on our next Citizens of the World tour to Vietnam with Jackie Lydon. Don't miss out on the opportunity. Call 1-800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, holiday music for sports fans, especially those who've heard, as I have, quite enough Jingle Cats. But first, a look at the week's sports stories with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Tuesday, Black Entertainment Television founder and owner Robert Johnson was anointed the billionaire who will bring the NBA back to Charlotte after a very brief absence. What does he offer that the Belkin Group did not?
A lot more money and the panache of being the first African-American team owner in a major sport. I know he's probably busy right now arranging for, you know, Trent Lott's debut as a talk show host in the Black Entertainment Network, entitled Trent Lott in the Hood. Now, whether there's an apostrophe before Hood in that case, I'm not really sure. But yeah, this is a great thing for the league. I'm sorry that Larry Bird won't be involved in the league, because he really is a terrific general manager in waiting. He has shown himself to be that. If I were Robert Johnson, I would make an overture.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Bird, of course, said that he was heartbroken not to have gotten the chance to build an NBA team from scratch. Now we just have to wait and see if he gets that chance someplace else.
Yeah, that's too bad. I really wish that Robert Johnson would reach out to Larry Bird and ML Carr and make them, you know, make ML Carr the liaison with the community, and give Larry Bird certainly a high-level job in the organization. I don't know that he won't. I don't know that Bird would take it, because he seems to be very, very loyal to Steve Belkin, who was the major investor in the group with which he was allied. But generally, this is a terrific thing for the league and a terrific thing for professional sports.
Today, two of the greatest college basketball coaches ever will oppose each other. Which one will prevail?
I think Jody Conrad will, because the game's at Texas. Otherwise, they're terrific, legendary coaches who have been, you know, scrabbling around for third and fourth. The fact that they are playing each other in a game in which one team is 21st in the ESPN USA Today rankings gives you a measure of how far women's basketball has come into colleges.
Absolutely.
Because the time was Tennessee, Texas, Louisiana Tech, and then name another women's team.
What a delight it must be for Pat Summitt, even though Tennessee isn't always number one or number two anymore. What a delight it must be to see all those contenders come on to the scene.
How is the view from the masthead of the good ship Lollipop, Bill? Pat Summitt is as cutthroat a competitor, male or female, as exists anyway. If she could guarantee her being number one by kidnapping and hiding in a mountain cave the other teams that might beat hers, she'd do it in a heartbeat.
The world can watch high school phenom LeBron James again during a four-day high school basketball tournament in February, assuming you can find the Yankees Entertainment and Sports Channel. Have you entered your subscription yet?
Well, considering a lot of people in New York can't find the Yankee Entertainment and Sports Channel, I doubt that I can. This is going to be the second stage in the ongoing explosive argument of what's going on with this kid. I don't want to talk about LeBron James being on television unless LeBron James gets a piece of the action. Mm-hmm. That's the way I feel.
I think probably we should actually congratulate ESPN on its restraint, because at least as far as I know, there is no LeBron James channel.
Actually, there is. The local cable access in Ohio, where he's from, is showing all these games. So I can't believe that there's anything on that channel except Sermonette and the local, you know, Board of Aldermen meetings and LeBron James basketball game.
On the Who Says Academics Don't Count front, Florida State quarterback Chris Ricks will miss the Sugar Bowl on December 28th because he slept through a final exam. This sends a message to student athletes everywhere, don't you think?
This is one of those where I think to myself, it's too bad this kid is a student athlete. How many kids did you know in college that slept through finals? I can give you five or six examples, but for my roommate's alarm clock, I could give you seven. this is sort of too bad. I'm sure that there's backstory here we don't know about, but, you know, let the kid, he slept through a final, let the kid play in the bowl game.
Mike Price, successful as the football coach at Washington State, will now try to succeed as the football coach at Alabama, which I would think might be a little bit different sort of challenge.
It's quite amazing that he's lasted at Washington State as long as he has. Mike Price is a terrific football coach. If you look at the quarterbacks he's had, from Drew Bledsoe to Jason Gesser, his teams play very well. He's revived that program. They play entertaining football. They're going to love him at Alabama. He's a real gentleman on top of everything else. And I think one of the reasons that he sort of never got mentioned for all of this was his teams might as well have been playing on the moon. I mean, Pullman, Washington is a hard place to get to.
Charlie, on Wednesday, Judge Kevin McCarthy ruled that Alex Popoff, who in October of last year caught Barry Bonds' 73rd home run, and Patrick Hayashi, who ended up with the ball after a melee, each own half the rights to the prize baseball. Couldn't these guys have figured that out without a judge and lawyers?
Well, since nobody in this case was in it for anything but for the money to start with, the order that they have the ball appraised, sell it, and split the proceeds is really the only thing this judge could do. This is one of those cases about which the great Mike Ricca would always write, the judge, who never dreamed he'd be involved in something like this when he was in law school. I think he made the right decision.
Last Saturday at the Junior Grand Prix final in Holland, 14-year-old figure skater Mickey Ando became the first competitor to land a quadruple jump, and this changes everything, right?
Oh, the Pixies are in an uproar! They're working on their quints right now. They're working on their sextuples. I'm sure this is a major. This is a big major event. But I'm wondering if Miki Ando will be able to do this when she's 17.
Finally, Charlie, in Tokyo, there's now an enormous chocolate image of soccer star David Beckham, unless it has rained or become unseasonably warm in the last little while. What star should be next, in your opinion, and in what medium?
Well, first of all, the Memphis Grizzlies' Jason Williams is already nicknamed White Chocolate, so we put him aside.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no question that in the center of Houston, there should be, for the season, a giant Yao Ming candy cane.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me at the candy store here at Only a Game each week. Happy holidays, Charlie.
Arigato, Bill-san.
Tis the season of giving, and in Cincinnati, the spirit has become manifest in City Councilman Chris Monzel. He's worked out a plan to give Bengals tickets to the last home game this season to underprivileged children. Chris Monzel joins me now on the phone from his office in Cincinnati. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
How did you come up with this idea?
Well, actually, my wife's family has had season tickets since the Bengals were founded back in 1968, mm-hmm. and they split the season games between the brothers and sisters, and we got tickets last weekend's game against the Jaguars, and unfortunately, we had another family commitment, and we were unable to get rid of the tickets. We actually left them in our mailbox for somebody to come by and pick them up, and they decided not to go to the game, and when we got home, it was too late to get rid of them. And we just had to swallow them, which was very disappointing. Mm. And when we found out that the actual attendance at the game was probably 20,000 or less, my wife and I were talking and felt, what a great loss of those tickets, people just not using them. Maybe we could come up with something that they could be given to kids who might never have a chance to see a Bengals game.
Now, some people who've heard about your plan have wondered out loud if giving Bengals tickets to children constitutes child abuse, since the team is 1-13 and they've been horrible for a decade. I assume you've been able to laugh that off.
Well, yes, and I can understand, the adults saying that with the performance of the team this year, which has been truly disappointing, and over the past several years. I mean, having grown up here in Cincinnati, I was a huge Bengal fan. But I think the kids, they still love the football stars, the Corey Dillons, the John Kitnas. They want to go out and see them play. And I think they would really care less about the record. I know they want them to win. But I think just to have a chance to go see them, an actual, real professional football game, is something that overwhelms, them. And really not a child abuse issue, but hopefully it would be one that would be a memory for them.
How many Bengals tickets have you accumulated so far?
We're trying to get a count on that. So I'm hoping we get a few hundred that we can pass out through our rec centers in the city mm-hmm. to kids that haven't ever gone to a Bengals game.
I heard a story a while back about a guy who had left his two Bengals tickets on the windshield of his car when he went shopping with a note inviting anybody who wanted them to take them. And when he returned from his errands, there were 6 tickets on his windshield. Are you at all concerned about finding takers for all the tickets you've collected?
No, I'm not. I think we have a great many kids in the city who would love to go to the game. I've heard that same story. I don't know if it's true or not.
It ought to be.
it's horrible. I mean, it just sounds horrible. But I think for the kids, they'll see past this, and I think they see the chance to get to actually watch Corey Dillon in a professional football game, we'll definitely want them to, go down there and see them. So I don't think we'll have problems getting kids to go down there and take the tickets.
Just strikes me that if this works, you have a possibility of creating one of the more interesting demographics in the National Football League. I don't think ever this was, thought of as something that would be entertainment for children above all else.
Yeah, we're... just trying to think out of the box here, and maybe this will be enough to spur the Bengals on to a victory, and hopefully come up with a policy maybe next year that they, whatever unused tickets they might have, they can give out to children's agencies throughout the city so that they can give some underprivileged child a chance to go see their game. So maybe that might be something Mike Brown will do next year, which I think would be a great idea.
Cincinnati City Councilman Chris Monzel is giving away Bengals tickets to kids this week. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Take care.
I wish you all pitches as fat and as high as a big harvest moon in a black background sky. These lines for the season and lots of lines that follow them, because once I got started, I kept thinking of more sports, were recently set to music by composer Tom Hojniaski and sung by the New World Chorale under the direction of Holly Krafka. This is only a game's first opportunity to showcase what a creative composer and a choir of great voices can do, even with my doggerel. Happy holidays.
Home team from my
Tom Hojniaski composed the music for Season's Greetings, which featured the New World Chorale under the direction of Holly McEwen Kratka.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from member station WPSU in State College, Pennsylvania. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about the book Silent Night, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from former NBA star and current hoops analyst, Charles Barkley.
Credit's always good when you got money.
Is that Sir Charles of the Alabama Barkleys or Sir Charles Dickens? Ah, well, God bless them, everyone. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.
Someday soon we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal-treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR, Weekend Edition. This is WBUR, Weekend Edition.